going ahead with the letter to the church at Thyatira. And we got down to the last part, the last few verses in that letter, and there are some very rich, some very rich thoughts at the close of that letter. And so I didn't want to rush over that at the end of the class last time. So just to kind of recap, remember that we began these letters with Ephesus. And Ephesus is in the south, and back then was located on the coast. It is now some miles back from the coast because of silting and things like that. But Ephesus was on the coast, and you start from Ephesus and go almost straight north to Smyrna. And then you go almost straight north to Pergamum. Once you get to Pergamum, then you start, you curve over and come back and start heading back down. So we're in the letter to Thyatira, and we've been emphasizing in each letter there's a self-designation, how Jesus identifies himself. And in this letter, he identifies himself as, "These things saith the Son of God, who hath his eyes like a flame of fire, and his feet are like unto burnished brass." There may be some way, there may be some connection between the designation and the particular church to which the letter is being written. Now, I'm not sure in all the letters I could satisfy myself that I knew exactly what the connection was. But here, there does seem to be an obvious one. "These things saith the Son of God, who hath his eyes like a flame of fire." In other words, the very penetrating gaze of the Lord, the sight of the Lord, that he sees the things that are going on. And so this is certainly true here in Thyatira. And this is the one where he commends them. But then in the condemnation, verse 20, "I have this against thee, that thou sufferest the woman Jezebel, who calleth herself a prophetess, and she teacheth and seduceth my servants to commit fornication and to eat things sacrificed to idols." So this is the problem that he deals with, that he condemns in the church at Thyatira. And he goes on then talking about that for several verses. So let's go on down now to verse 25. "Nevertheless, that which ye have, hold fast till I come." So he wants something done about Jezebel. He himself is going to do something about it. He says, "I'm going to kill her children with pestilence," and so on. But nevertheless, this church at Thyatira is encouraged to hold fast what you have, you know, the good things that you do have. And verse 25, "He that overcometh," so you've got this promise in every letter, "to him that overcometh, and he that keepeth my works unto the end, to him will I give authority over the nations." Okay, now right here, we get into that part that I'm talking about that I think is so incredibly rich. And a lot of the reason why it is rich is because of its connections to the Old Testament prophecies, but also because of what it means to you and me as Christians. In several different verses in the book of Revelation, he makes points having to do with this kingdom that he's the kingdom of priests. I was just looking here at one of them in Revelation 20 and verse 6. "Blessed and holy is he that hath part in the first resurrection. Over these the second death hath no power, but they shall be priests of God and of Christ, and shall reign with him 1,000 years. And earlier, we also have statements to that effect, that they reign with him, so that we share in the rule of Jesus. We don't share with him in that rule as if we were the king, or as if we were actually flexing that power, but because Jesus is our king and we are his, then over and over again, the Bible emphasizes our sharing the things that he has, that he shares those things with us. We are given a lot in the heritage that he was given of God. And so this is one of those areas there. "To him that overcometh, I will give authority over the nations." Now notice verse 27. "He shall rule them with a rod of iron, as the vessels of the potter are broken to shivers." Now, do you recognize the very unmistakable allusion there? Second song. You will rule them with a rod of iron. You will break them in pieces like a potter's vessel. That's the very way that the verse reads. It might be worth your while just to take a glance at that. Psalm 2, verse 9. Thou shalt break them with a rod of iron. Thou shalt dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. You hear that? Now, here in verse 27 of Revelation 2, he shall rule them with a rod of iron, as the vessels of the potter are broken to shivers. Do you see the similarity? I mean, the similarity is unmistakable. But in the second psalm, that statement is made to Jesus. That is part of the promise given to Jesus. When God is talking to him in that psalm, telling him, "You are my son, this day have I begotten thee. Ask of me, I will give thee the nations for thine inheritance, and the uttermost parts of the earth for thy possession. Thou shalt break them with a rod of iron. Thou shalt dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel." Clearly then, the reference here is to this rule of Jesus. But he's not talking about Jesus in verse 27 of Revelation 2. The one he's talking about there is the one that overcomes. The one there at Thyatira or anywhere else that overcomes. To him will I. See, the I is Jesus. So this is not a reference here in Revelation 2 to Jesus. This is a reference to what Jesus himself is going to do and what he promises to do. I will give authority to him that overcomes. Give authority over the nations. He shall rule them with a rod of iron. Now, another thing or two just about that rod. In Isaiah 11 and verse 4. Isaiah 11, verse 4. Now, this passage is in a messianic passage. Isaiah 11, 1 says, "There shall come forth a shoot out of the stock of Jesse, and a branch out of his root shall bear fruit." This is a messianic passage. And it talks about the Spirit of the Lord resting upon him, and his delight being in the fear of the Lord, and so on. In verse 4, "But with righteousness shall he judge the poor, and decide with equity for the meek of the earth, and he shall smite the earth with the rod of his mouth." So the thing about Isaiah 11, 4 is it helps us to see, it clarifies what this rod is back here in Psalm 2. This rod is the authority of Jesus expressed by his word, expressed by his commandments. And also remember that it's in Isaiah 49 that he talks about God as Jesus there prophetically is speaking. And he says, "God has made my mouth a sharp sword." So do you recall that when we talked about the figure here in Revelation about the sharp sword proceeding out of the mouth of Jesus? And now here is this idea about the rod from Psalm 2, verse 9. Isaiah 11, 4 identifies that rod as the rod of his mouth, therefore the idea of his word, his authority. And so as you and I participate in the rule of Jesus, then through him we rule the nations with a rod of iron, as the vessels of the potter are broken to shivers, as I also have received of my Father. Now, that part is a reference to the authority that Jesus has received. And so what he's promising is that we will share with him in that rule. And the very fact that he's talking here about our sharing with him in what he has might also have something to do back in verse 17, "To him that overcometh, to him will I give of the hidden manna." And I remember that Buford was making the point that the sustenance that is of Jesus himself. So I think that would very possibly fit in with the idea that he gives of himself, sustenance of himself. And here he is giving us to share in the authority, in the power that he has from the Father. So that verse, Revelation 2 and verse 27, is a very, very clear allusion to that second psalm. But you'll notice that once again, the way it does it is, he doesn't actually quote that. He just uses somewhat the language of it. So again, that's why we use the word allusion rather than a quotation. So this is not just Thyatira. The overcoming promises would apply to any Christian. All of these overcoming promises would be true of all Christians who do succeed in overcoming. All right, so anyone have a comment that you want to add in the letter to the church at Thyatira down through verse 27? Anything about that rod of iron? Any comment? Yes. And I think that it is a power that means that, you know, as we have studied before, in the Old Testament, God long ago pronounced what was the end of all earthly physical nations. Those of us who have chosen to follow the way of the Lord have chosen a kingdom that will never be destroyed, haven't we? We are therefore a part of the kingdom that shall never be destroyed. That kingdom that shall never be destroyed is also a kingdom that shall break in pieces and consume all these other kingdoms. So as a part of that kingdom, we are a part of that which breaks in pieces and consumes all the other nations. So as Buford says, you know, anyone looking for, well, where's my scepter? And, you know, won't actually be a little Saddam Hussein or somebody like that. No, that's not the picture here at all. Totally not the picture. But the picture is that we are on the side of the king and that we are a part of his reign. We're not just his subjects. We're also a part of his reign. And that is what a gracious thing God has done in giving us that blessing. And it's interesting that as you study passages like Ephesians 1, that he made us to be a heritage, a part of his own heritage, meaning he shared with us the heritage that he had. So we're a part of the heritage. So it's really, really interesting. All right, look at verse 28 as he goes on with the promise here of what will be done. And I will give him the morning star. I will give him the morning star. Now, again, to find out what this means, we have to be careful and use the language of the Bible itself. In Revelation 22 and verse 16, I, Jesus, have sent mine angel to testify unto you these things for the churches. I am the root and the offspring of David, the bright, the morning star. Now here Jesus refers to himself as the morning star. And there are several verses that probably have some relationship to this, such as 2 Peter chapter 1 and verse 19. We have the word of prophecy made more sure, whereunto ye do well that ye take heed, as unto a lamp shining in a dark place, until the day dawn and the day star arise in your hearts. The idea there being that those that have the Old Testament, the prophecies of that Old Testament were like lights that we would do well to pay heed to in the night until the dawn come and the day star arise, which means when the fullness of the revelation of Jesus. And of course, that was in the very process of being done. You know, there in 2 Peter, the scriptures were being written probably by that time. Paul had written almost all of his, probably had written all of his. So in that century in which 2 Peter is written, that which Peter is talking about was realized. But those who had the Old Testament prophecies that pointed the way to Jesus were like people in the night. And so whatever light they did have, you do well to take heed to that light until the day dawn and the day star arise. So the day star there would be the star indicating the coming of the day and probably be the same thing as the morning star. So the promise of Jesus here, I will give him the morning star. Most likely the idea, there are two things that come to mind. One is the sharing of the glory of Jesus Again, the idea of the sharing of the glory of Jesus. I think there is some evidence that would support that. And the other is the idea of enlightenment. Perhaps the idea of enlightenment, as Paul prayed in Ephesians 1, having the eyes of your heart enlightened, that you may know what is the hope of his calling, what the riches of the glory of his inheritance in the saints, and what the greatness of his power to usward who believe. So you have two ideas there. Maybe sharing in the glory, that is, the glory of Jesus as the morning star, or perhaps the idea of enlightenment that we share in, but whatever it is, I will give him the morning star. But since Jesus himself identifies himself as the morning star, then I think we would have to relate whatever this promise is to Jesus. So either the idea of the sharing of his glory or the sharing of his knowledge, the light, being enlightened, that kind of an idea. I enjoy having choices like that because they're both real, real good choices. Any comment? Yes, Trevor. Yes. And since you mentioned that one, let me go back to that one just a moment. Isaiah 14 and verse 12. Now, this is the one that and I know you know about this, but this is the one that is the basis of, I'd have to call it the mythology that the world has created about the devil. Now, that doesn't mean the devil is a myth. But the world has its own mythology it has invented and come up with. Like, you know, he's red, has a kind of a pointed tail, goes about with his pitchfork, you know, and all that stuff. Got horns. One of his names that this mythology gives him is Lucifer, based on verse 12, Isaiah 14, in the King James Version. How art thou fallen from heaven, O day star, son of the morning? How art thou cut down to the ground that didst lay low the nations? If you will look in the context makes it absolutely clear. This is the king of Babylon. This has nothing to do with the devil. And some who even take the position, they will say, yes, this is the king of Babylon. I've seen some of them even try to establish some kind of connection between the king of Babylon and the devil. Well, there's absolutely no reason to do that. It is sufficient to observe the context, which begins in chapter 13:1, the burden of Babylon. And then as you go on down, right on down, just following the words right on down, like verse 17 of chapter 13, behold, I will stir up the Medes against them. Against them. That's the Babylonians, against the Babylonians. Verse 19, in Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldeans' pride shall be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. Now in chapter 14, in contrast to what God is going to do to Babylon, the Lord will have compassion on Jacob and will yet choose Israel and set them in their own land. And so here he is promising and so on. All right, now follow verse 3. And it shall come to pass in the day that the Lord shall give thee rest from thy sorrow and from thy trouble and from the hard service wherein thou wast made to serve. Now see, this is an address to God's people. That you will take up this parable against whom? The king of Babylon. And say, how hath the oppressor ceased? And so that's the verses as they go on down, that's whom you're addressing. Like verse 11, thy pomp is brought down to Sheol, and the noise of thy vials, the worm is spread under thee, and worms cover thee. How art thou fallen from heaven? He is talking about the king of Babylon who was, you know, supreme. He was above all the other kings of his day. Remember Nebuchadnezzar? Remember how Nebuchadnezzar was? Remember the idea that God drove him from among men until he learned that God rules in the kingdoms of men and so on. So that's all this is saying. However, there is, I think, something here that is worth considering. The point that's being made in verse 12, though it is being made about the king of Babylon, has to do with the glory of the king of Babylon, doesn't it? The glory which he had. And how that glory came down, fell down. How art thou fallen from heaven? I mean, old Nebuchadnezzar, Babylon was up there. It was as high as the heaven. The language is used in these kings and about these kings of themselves. So that's the point. But the day star, this idea of the morning star here, is the idea of how glorious he was. A while ago, when I was talking to you about the two ideas the morning star might have, I said one of them was glory. I mentioned some of the evidence of that. This passage in Isaiah 14 is part of the evidence for that. That the language is being used here, the king of Babylon, in describing the glory which he had possessed, but from which he fell when the end came for Babylon and for the king. So that just goes back to that idea of the morning star in Revelation 2 at the close of the chapter. Is it the idea of sharing the glory? I think probably it is. But it could be the idea of sharing enlightenment based on 2 Peter chapter 2. Okay? Buford, do you have any thought about that?
I'm reminded there of
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes. Yes. That's right. And that goes back to the point you made about the hidden manna, doesn't it? That he's sharing himself with us. And that's a wonderful idea. It's a beautiful idea, a very, very powerful idea. And you know, one of the things that we think about when we're thinking about all that he's promising here for us is how we totally don't deserve it. Do you think about that? How totally we don't deserve it. But he is giving this great promise and this great blessing to those who have followed him, who have made their covenant with him, and who follow him. So what a blessing, what an absolute blessing it is. And he closes with the statement that he makes over and over, the exhortation, "He that hath ears to hear, let him hear what the Spirit saith to the churches." All right, so there's Thyatira. Thyatira and Pergamum both are dealing with false teaching that is in the midst of these churches. And it's interesting, you go back to Ephesus, and boy, one thing Ephesus was not doing was putting up with false teaching. Great. That's great, Ephesus. But you've lost your first love. So you're going to have to shape up and get back that zeal. So it's true, you're not going to be cast out because you tolerated false doctrine. But you've got a problem that you need to deal with. Now, here these churches are. There are some good things that Jesus has commended about them. But their problem is false doctrine. And the toleration of false doctrine and the practice of false doctrine. And he says this absolutely cannot be. It cannot be. I want to remind you of the reason why we have these letters. And by the way, there are several thoughts that occur to my mind here that I've been wanting to tell you. Our course will go a good bit faster once we get through these letters. Because like chapter 4 is going to be a picture. It's going to be a great picture. It's going to be a great vision. It's not going to be broken up into these seven letters that we need to give attention to, each letter. So we're going to be going faster after that. But the purpose of these letters being given here, I believe, is in order that God may make the point, that particularly that Jesus may make the point, that before we Christians are ready to deal with the external forces that go on in the world out here, we've got to make sure that that of which we are a part spiritually is what it ought to be. Bill?
I think of the many times you talk about sound church.
Uh-huh.
Maybe sound on certain issues.
Yes. And that kind of has bugged me over the years, and I believe it has you too. Somebody would say, that church sound, and almost always what they're talking about is one thing. And it is not a spiritual thing for us to equate the soundness of a church with one thing. It is true that if there is one area that that church is severely lacking, what is the lesson of these letters? Then it's not sound. It's got some work to do, right? But soundness is something which means health. Health. The word sound has to do with health. Is it sound? So that's a good point to make. And so all of these things, we need to be concerned about all of these things. Attitudes, false teaching. The practice of false teaching. In other words, I'm saying that sometimes you can have something false being taught, not practiced. But usually if it is taught, then what is going to follow that? Then the practice will follow. And so we see in these letters that that's exactly what has happened. So remember that I say again, as you look at the book of Revelation as a whole, you want to be sure and say, okay, what's the role of these two chapters, 2 and 3? And if you'll take 1, 2, and 3, here is Jesus in the midst of the churches, in absolute control, and they exist by His grace, by His sufferance, but He is the one that sharp sword comes out of His mouth. He's the one who has the 7 stars in His hand. And there the lampstands are. He has absolute control over these churches. And so before we saints focus upon the external forces of life and the world, we need to get things straightened out here in the fort before we take the battle to the enemy. Do you see what I'm saying? I believe that's the idea. That's why these chapters are here. Because what he's going to show is that beginning with chapter 5, when the Lamb appears, the Lamb that had been as if it had been slain, this Lamb shows up. He takes the scroll out of the hand of the one that sits upon the throne. He begins to open the seals of this scroll, and man, things begin to happen. And so before we deal with those things that as Christians we deal with in the world, not just things like persecution, not just things like evil, but things like death. We have to deal with all of those. Before we are ready to deal with those, we need to be sure that we have our spiritual house in order. You see how important that is? That is so important. And that's the reason why these letters begin the study of the revelation of the book of Revelation. All right, in chapter 3, yes, Buford. Yeah, right. That's exactly right. And you can find there are numerous passages that have that idea. Yeah, so you're right. This is nothing new. Yes. 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 In other words, cast the beam out of your own eye. Yeah. All right, good points. All right, let's look now at this letter to the church at Sardis. And just remember, the horseshoe just keeps on coming down here over there in Asia. in the province of Asia. It just keeps on coming down here to Sardis. To the angel of the church at Sardis. Right. Oh boy. I would hate to be at Sardis. "These things saith he that hath the seven spirits of God and the seven stars." And of course, we've already talked about all of that. The idea of the seven spirits, the idea of the fullness of the Holy Spirit. And the seven stars, the seven angels, and we talked about those. We didn't come up with much definitive, but we talked about them. But this is the one who knows, this is the one who is in control. "I know thy works." I know thy works. Now that's the way he started out with Thyatira. "I know thy works." And in Ephesians, or the letter to the church at Ephesus, "I know thy works." Now in Smyrna, he says, "I know thy tribulation and poverty." And so Smyrna did not have anything that he condemned. But "I know." In Pergamum, "I know where you dwell." So he didn't say that every time. He didn't say, "I know your works," but he said it several times. And so as he goes here at Sardis, "I know thy works." And here's the bad part, that you have a name that you live and you are dead. So just tell me, what would that mean? You have a name that you live, but you're dead. So what would that mean? Let's take reputation. What's the reputation of Sardis? Well, the thing is, name just means you have a reputation. You have a name that you live. So the idea is, All right. Are you aware of the fact? Yeah, Trevor, go ahead. Yeah, they have a reputation of being a sound church. All right, so they have a reputation. Everybody thinks, you know, there are churches that you just mention the name. You don't even have to tell where it is. You just mention the name. And everybody will say, "Yeah, boy, that is a great church." And then sometimes you'll find out suddenly something will happen and you'll say, "What in the world happened?" Well, it had a reputation. And there were some things that were going on that were not known. Harold? Idea. Right. Yeah. Yeah. A lot of talk. And you know, here's another thing. And I think about, of course, are you doing like I, you know, I'm thinking about, well, what about East Side here? A lot of times what a church does is it lives on what it used to be. I've known churches that as they decayed, they lived on what they used to be. And we must be careful that we don't live on what we used to be. That we maintain the work of the Lord. And that we maintain our zeal. And that we keep this work going. And I like to think about, you know, the idea that we'll sometimes use on watch. We'll talk about it's our watch. And we can't take the glory of someone else's watch. We're on watch. This is our turn. And so we have to be sure that the things about the church are what they ought to be. And another thing that we need to understand here, because this is something which so often is not understood, and that is that that to keep the church strong is not going to be a job that the elders can do without the cooperation of the members. It's not something that the elders can do. It's not something that the preacher can do. All of us have to do individually, in our lives, in our work, in the things that we want, in the things that are important, the things we desire, the things we pray for. The things we work for and what we do from day to day, those are the things that we have to do to make sure that the church is strong. And I am very glad that as I go about and visit, I will sit in someone's living room and they'll tell me about one thing after another that some of you have done that you haven't broadcast. Nobody knew it. I wouldn't know it if I weren't there talking with them. And I appreciate that. That's the way it ought to be. But here's a church, Sardis. You have a name that you live, and you're dead. Yes. Yeah, that's right. Right. And one thing that points out is that when there are things wrong with the church, that doesn't necessarily mean that everyone in that church is to be tarred with that brush. So let's look at a few more things that we'll get there. All right, verse 2, be thou watchful and establish the things that remain which were ready to die. For I have found no works of thine perfected before my God. Now, one reason why I spend a good bit of time on these letters is because they offer such terrific advice, such good things to think about. Now, you take that thought. Now, suppose you're obviously, in the Lord's view, you're dealing with a church here that apparently doesn't have much going on. So what's the first thing to do? Kill it. Just go ahead and kill it. No, don't kill it. What do? Fan the flame. Exactly. You maintain what is there. Maintain what is going on. Don't let that go out. Be watchful. Establish the things that remain which were ready to die. They're not dead. They're ready to die. Now, the church as a whole, he says, you're dead. But, of course, he is saying that overall you're dead. Now, there are some things, the things that even are not dead, they're ready to die. Don't let those die. Take it where it is and start up. That's what he's telling this church. He's not telling them, just kill it off. No, he is saying, take what is there. Don't let it die. Fan it. And this part, for I have found no works of thine perfected before my God. The thing is, both individually and collectively, we can sometimes come up with some of the best plans you ever heard of. Aren't we humans pretty good about that? We come up with the best plans you ever heard of. But it's not the planning that is so bad. It's the execution, isn't it? That we don't follow through. Or maybe we'll start out and we don't keep it going. It just dies. We let it drop. It's not carried through. And that will ensure the death of a church. It will ensure the deterioration of a church. We have to keep things, we have to keep our minds stirred up. We have to keep the minds of one another stirred up. Encourage one another. Provoke one another unto love and good works. So this is a thing we just need to be careful about. This is what was wrong with Sardis. I have found no works of thine perfected before my God. Grown, but not grown what like they should have. Grown in what ways? Different ways. Remember therefore how thou hast received and didst hear, and keep it and repent. So remember. Remember what you have heard. I tell my little 5th and 6th graders that it is not only a matter of what is preached to you, it is a matter of what you have heard and listened to. Because would you believe it? I have some of them that have a terrible time staying awake. The reason why they have a terrible time staying awake is because they stay up till 11 or 12 playing computer games and doing who knows what else, and they don't get enough sleep. So the next day, they're hung over at their desk, and they don't hear. And so likewise, I've made the point a lot of times in sermons that it's not just what preaching has been done, it is what preaching has been listened to. And it's not just physical sleep that will keep you from perceiving that preaching. It is also a lack of concentration on it, with your mind distracted and somewhere else. So Sardis had heard some preaching. They had had some preaching. Remember, therefore, how you have received and didst hear. And do what with it? Keep it. So let us resolve. Let us resolve that we're going to work hard to listen, to assimilate that which is taught, to make it a part of us. So remember how you've received and you heard, and keep it and repent. If therefore thou shalt not watch, I will come as a thief, and thou shalt not know what hour I will come upon thee. Now, one of the things that I have read about Sardis is that there were at least two times the city was built upon a very naturally fortified area. On three sides, you really couldn't very well mount an attack. And so it's easily fortified on that other side. And yet, on two occasions, soldiers had found a way up a crevice or something, had gotten inside. So that point is made that that would have particular meaning to them. It's pretty interesting, and maybe it does. Here's a city that has been taken by surprise a couple of times. So, you better repent, or I will come as a thief. You won't know what hour I will come. So, maybe that would have particular application to them. All right, what we'll do is, the bell has rung, hasn't it? First one, all right. Well, let's go ahead and we'll plan to take up about verse 3 there and look at the rest of this letter.